From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a federal judge hands Larry Nassar what is essentially a life sentence for possessing child pornography. Plus, we hear from a group opposing legalized marijuana.
If we really want to talk about controlling drug use and controlling opiates, we're not going to take the step of legalizing a recreational drug that is currently illegal.
The mega auto supplier Delphi vanishes to be replaced by two companies headquartered in the UK.
There's distinction between the old line auto manufacturing and the high-tech technology worlds is blurring.
The passive house, the cure for your home energy bill blues.
We can reduce the energy consumption of that house by 80 to 90% over a conventional code-built home.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Earlier this month, supporters of legalized marijuana in Michigan delivered more than enough signatures to tentatively qualify for a ballot proposal in November of 2018. My next guest is heading an effort to stop that measure from passing. The group is called Healthy and Productive Michigan, fighting legalized marijuana. Scott Greenlee is the president of the group, and he is with us now. Scott, what are your main arguments against having recreational marijuana in Michigan?
First, thanks for having me on. And really, there's a lot of arguments for having a block on recreational use of marijuana. One of the things is medical, obviously. Most medical professionals are against this. And while there are some who support recreational marijuana that would tell you that it's not harmful, most medical studies that are reviewed will tell you that it does cause not only short but long-term and can be significant medical issues. A lot of people have talked about the tax dollars it will generate. As folks have found out in Colorado, the tax dollars come along with a cost. And interestingly enough, in a lot of cases, tax dollar projections and revenue projections don't come quite in where they should.
But we do know that there are states that are seeing their coffers fattened by it. I know Nevada generated more than $3.5 million in tax revenues in just the first month of its legalized pot. But you talk about the costs associated. Like what?
Well, it's interesting when you take a look at the first month or the first few months versus long-term effects. You know, there's going to be a significant discussion with regard to how legalized recreational marijuana is managed in our state. There will be costs that inherently come along with that, whether it's law enforcement type costs, whether it's actual increased research costs, whether it's medical costs. And I think by and large, typically these type of projections and these type of hype statements don't come into where they're projected to be. I think Colorado has a good story about that, and our committee will be making that clear as the campaign goes on.
What is Colorado's story? What have they seen?
Well, Colorado's had a lot of issues. You know, they just had their fifth year of legalized recreational marijuana. And most of what they had hoped would be the case is not the case. They've got obviously increased medical challenges. That's well documented. They've got a very challenged business climate right now with companies that are trying to hire different people for different levels of jobs and have a requirement for being drug-free, many of which is mandated by unions, not able to find enough people to work for them. It's also an issue with site selection when a company's relocating. Do they want to go to a state where recreational marijuana is allowed, or do they want to go to a state where it isn't allowed? So there have been a number of challenges.
And we have read here a lot of stories about the law enforcement challenges, too, with drugged driving and that type of problem that these states, I know we're looking at five states plus D.C. that have legalized pot. You know, just after the petition signatures were turned in, I spoke with Josh Hovey of the Coalition to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol, and he had this to say, talking about fundraising and the effort in Arizona that was successful in derailing the legalized pot ballot proposal in 2016.
What we saw in Arizona was makers of certain opiate drugs, actually the pharmaceutical manufacturers of those drugs, funded an opposition campaign to legalization. So we are expecting that as a very real possibility in 2018, and we'll be fundraising like mad to make sure that the myths are busted and the facts are out there.
I want to ask you, Scott, when you think about a company that makes money from selling something like fentanyl, which is a big part of America's opioid crisis, arguing that marijuana is too dangerous to legalize for recreational use, what do you make of that argument?
You know, I don't speak for them. I haven't talked to them. I don't know where they're coming from, but I do know that marijuana is absolutely a gateway drug, and that's been proven and documented by medical research time and time again. And I think that when we take a look at opiates and we take a look at harder drugs, marijuana is the gateway. When I was in high school here in Michigan about 30 years ago, almost 35 years ago now, it was a situation where in 9th and 10th grade, I saw a lot of kids start to do cigarettes. And what do you know, by 11th or 12th grade, some of them would start to do marijuana. And then some of those same folks who took that step when they got into college started experimenting with even more dangerous and even what we'd call harder drugs. I was fortunate in the fact that I have asthma. So I've never even had a puff of a regular cigarette, not to mention anything else. I never got started on that track. Unfortunately, I've seen so many people that have. And if we really want to talk about controlling drug use and controlling opiates, we're not going to take the step of legalizing a recreational drug that is currently illegal.
Can I ask, have you accepted any contributions from any companies that make these powerful opiate painkillers?
I have not.
Would you consider taking donations, or would you be willing to say on the record you would not accept any donations from companies that make opiates?
You know, I would probably have a discussion with them. I would talk to anybody who wants to partner with the mission of the organization, as I think anyone would be wise to do. So I'm not going to give a blanket statement along those lines. I'd want to see what their case is, why they're opposed, and I'd make a decision along with my board at that point.
And how will you be out there pushing this message? How will Healthy and Productive Michigan be reaching out to Michigan voters?
What's wonderful is we have a very large coalition. You know, when you think about people that are opposed to legalization, you've got the vast majority of law enforcement. You've got the vast majority of healthcare professionals. You've got the business community led by the Michigan Chamber that has already passed a resolution opposing any form of recreational marijuana. And we talked a little bit about the challenges earlier that the business community faces in states that have legalized recreational marijuana. You have faith-based communities. You have a lot of different avenues of coalitions that are against this. So we're going to be doing a lot of town halls. We're going to be doing a lot of electronic and earned media, really trying to educate the public on the fact that this is a challenge and that if it's passed, it's something that is going to cause Michigan to not be as healthy and productive as we currently are.
Scott Greenlee is president of Healthy and Productive Michigan. Scott, thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you.
When you buy that bouquet of flowers for someone special, do you know where those flowers are usually grown? Colombia? The Netherlands? How about right in your own community? A new group based in Ann Arbor has expanded upon the burgeoning local food movement to include locally grown flowers. It's called the Michigan Flower Growers Cooperative. Once a week, from spring to fall, the co-op allows growers to sell wholesale to floral designers, florists, and distributors. Many of these flower growers work full-time jobs, so the co-op lets them drop off their lilies, daisies, and tulips and then come back later to pick up a check. Stateside's Danny Hensel visited the market before it closed for the season, and he brought us back this audio postcard.
Flower pods are totally edible.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, like these flower pods? This little, like the one before they turn and form a bead.
Hi, my name's Amanda Mauerman. I wear many different hats for the co-op. I'm one of the founding members. I'm a board member, I'm the current market manager, and I'm a grower, and I'm a buyer.
We're a farmer-owned cooperative, so all of these farms are either in Ann Arbor, Detroit, Ypsilanti, and even south of us. As far as buyers go, we have a mix of studio florists as well as retail flower shops. And then, as you saw today, we also have some DIY folks coming who are doing events for friends or, you know, brides who want to do their own flowers for their weddings. And so we're a great source for them to get a variety of flowers at a wholesale price.
We have kale, which is nice greenery for bouquets. We have some marigolds as well, some zinnias. We also have some sage. I'm Christopher Hallett, and I work at Growing Hope. It's incredible to be able to drop flowers off here and see people walking around and buying them and, yeah, having that network already in place.
Yeah. She names each bouquet different names.
Really? No, I don't know about funny.
How do you do that?
She named this one Roy G. Bibb. That's hilarious.
My name's Liz Dahl McGregor. I am actually getting flowers for my sister's wedding.
I am Jeanette, and I'm here helping her.
I'm really impressed with the diversity that's here. Color and just the quality. Really impressive. Look at this kale. I mean, these are perfect.
It's so amazing. I mean, I don't know. I'm a huge advocate for resilience and being able to have what we need as much as possible in our community. So to get flowers that are grown here by our farmers, it's priceless. Do you know what those are?
Those are asters.
Those are asters?
Yeah.
Oh. They're so fun.
Oh, I know.
This was necessary. This was necessary not just because local flowers are due their time, but because there's a lot of small and independent growers who really need support and need a viable business, and flowers are it.
I'm Marilyn Crowley. I'm a grower for the Flower Cooperative. My farm is Pistol Production. I found out about this group in spring, and I didn't plan to have this opportunity to sell so many flowers, so I didn't have that much to sell this year because I just grew enough flowers for myself and my friends. But next year I'm going to grow only flowers in my property. It gives me the benefit of not having to be here or sit at a farmer's market. So I work full time. After my day job, I come home on a Tuesday, I harvest, and then I drop off all the flowers before work, and then they handle all of the sales and I get a check.
The market currently is every Wednesday from 8 to 11 a.m. This year we ran from July through October, and next year for 2018, we're gonna start in April. We've reached our sales goal for the first year already. Grower payouts have been great. Our growers are very happy and are very jazzed about getting together to talk about what we're going to plant for next year.
Oh, well, enjoy the flowers.
I'm so excited.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm excited. Thanks.
The Flower Cooperative reopens in April 2018. You can get more information at michiganradio.org. Coming up on the next idea, passive houses turn conventional thinking about heating and cooling upside down.
It's like having a hole in your building or a window opening without having the energy penalty.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening.
Experimentation.
Vision.
The next idea.
People mean very different things whenever they talk about innovation.
From the Sears kit houses of the early 1900s to the Farmfield McMansions of the 90s, the way we heat and cool our homes has pretty well followed this formula. You build a space the size you want and then install heating and cooling to keep the square footage comfortable. Today's guest on The Next Idea is building a house in Washtenaw County that turns that whole equation on its head. Michael Clement is the founder of the firm Architectural Resource, and he's working on what's called a passive house. And he's here with us now to tell us more about the concept. Michael, welcome to The Next Idea.
Cynthia, it is a thrill to be here with you and share this groundbreaking idea and this groundbreaking house that we're putting together.
You're going to be building the first passive house in Washtenaw County. What is the theory behind a passive house? How is it different from what we've been building houses for the last 200 years or so?
Well, and the lead into this interview, you correctly stated how we've been typically doing things is we build what we want, and then we just get a big enough sledgehammer to heat and cool that house. Passive house takes the approach that what if we looked at energy performance as one of the key metrics of our design protocol? The concept behind passive house is if we can design, site, and build a house in such a fashion, we can reduce the energy consumption of that house by 80 to 90% over a conventional code-built home. With technology we have right now, right here, today. And then the idea is by reducing the amount of energy consumption that the house requires, because the cleanest, greenest, and cheapest energy is that energy we don't have to add to the system, we can then add the ever so smallest amount of energy using fossil fuels. Or, in many cases, we can use renewable energy, such as solar panels, and make the house net zero, or in some cases, net positive energy.
When you say 80 to 90% over what most of us are paying to heat and cool our houses, that is gobsmacking.
It really is.
Where did this all come from?
Great question. So as you remember, we had this little thing called the oil embargo back in the mid-70s. And that catalyzed a lot of different thinking in terms of how we considered our homes and energy. Believe it or not, in Urbana, Illinois, the passive house concept was first hatched. That's where it took hold. And then, of course, the oil embargo over, we invent the SUV, we forget everything. We're not the sharpest crayons in the box, it appears.
We do not have long memories.
We don't have long memories. So the concept of passive house then jumped across the pond, and a gentleman named Wolfgang Feist took this concept and then did the German thing to it, and added a lot of math and science behind it and developed a program which allowed a very highly technical evaluation of the various different aspects and parameters of a home to be paired up with the energy possibility of the sun and internal gains, such as your own body heat, plug loads, lighting, and designed a metric which is called the Passive House Institute of Europe. That then came back across the pond with a woman named Katrin Klingberg. And Katrin set up office in Illinois and established the Passive House Institute of the United States. Why this is uniquely important is that in Germany, it's essentially the same climate zone from north to south. So it's essentially homogeneous. The weather and the temperature and anything we're going to be looking at is going to be the same.
Not so in the U.S.
Not so in the U.S. In the U.S., we have climate zones all the way from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to Spokane, Washington, to Boise, Idaho, to Tempe, Arizona. Completely different in terms of both temperature, but also humidity and weather durability, exposure to moisture, rain, all that stuff. So the brilliant idea that Katrin put together is working with the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, NREL, out in Colorado, and the Department of Energy. She established the Passive House Institute of the United States protocol, which is climate specific. So we have metrics to hit that are different depending on where you are in the country.
Which makes sense. So what you're going to build in Washtenaw County is nothing like what you would want to build if you're building in Arizona.
That's exactly the idea. And what we were finding is that using the European standard for passive house performance, we were running into overheating situations. We were also running into very significant conversations about the return on investment and the economics of how much insulation that they were adding. In fact, kind of an eye-opening article came out in a publication called The Green Building Advisor called How Much Insulation is Too Much. And so what Katrin did with the Passive House Institute of the United States is by pairing up with the Department of Energy and a program called BEOPT, B-E-O-P-T, Building Efficiency Optimization. They've actually tuned this, so we're looking at the ideal amount of insulation for the specific climate, specifically where you are in the country. It's brilliant.
Now, a lot of people have heard the term LEED certification for buildings. This is not that. How do they compare? How do they differ?
It is completely different from LEED. LEED is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, and it's a program that's been put together by the United States Green Building Council, which is a non-governmental entity which has been established to forward the concept of sustainable design and building. It's phenomenal. We have actually done several LEED certified projects. We were responsible for the first LEED certified whole house remodel in Michigan, and we're actually working on a project down in Jefferson City, Missouri, which is going to be that state's second LEED certified new home construction. LEED looks at what's called resource categories, and there are eight different resource categories that range everywhere from location and linkages, how close or far you are from an urban center, which impacts your energy and your sustainable aspects, water conservation, indoor air quality, site development, materials usage. It's a broad brush look at many areas of sustainability. Passive house, Orpheus, in our case, thank you, focuses on specifically one particular area, energy consumption. And the passive house concept is if you look at our situation as a species on the planet and what we're facing currently, that the highest and most important thing that we need to focus on is climate change. And that drives directly to carbon dioxide production, which drives directly to fossil fuel consumption. And so the whole focus for FIAS is on energy consumption because they feel that that is the most, all the other aspects are very important, absolutely important. But I have to tell you, I have a lot more clients coming to me who are interested in reducing or in many cases eliminating their energy bill. And that's what FIAS focuses on.
Does a passive house look different?
So funny you should say that because a passive house doesn't have to look any different than any other home.
If you've got a traditionally built house, would you be able to retrofit it?
You absolutely can retrofit it, yes.
Okay.
What we look at in passive house is we want to pay a lot of attention to the building envelope. I call it our third skin. So we have our first skin, which is our skin, our second skin, which is our clothing, and our third skin, which is the building envelope. We want to reduce the amount of energy loss through that envelope so much that we can literally heat our house with light bulbs, your cat, your body heat, a few neighbors coming over. And to do that with an existing house, what we basically do is add additional layers of insulation to the exterior. Outside of the insulation that we're looking at, which drives to something called R value. R stands for resistance to energy flow. So we want to increase the R value of our envelope so we reduce the energy flow. But what we also want to look at is this insidious hidden energy loser, which is the leakiness of our homes. This is called convective energy loss. The DOE claims that most of our houses, conventionally built, have, if you aggregate all of the leakage holes you have in your house, a 3-square-foot hole that's 24/7, 365, taking that heat that you paid and the moisture you added and right out the window.
Or the cooling that you're adding in August.
Exactly. It's a two-way door. So in passive house, the metrics that we have to hit for certification are 5 in design and 1 in construction. The 5 in design, we look at peak heating and peak cooling. We look at annual heating and annual cooling energy consumption. And we look at source energy consumption. Source energy is really critical. When people talk about a net zero home, they're usually talking about site net zero home. Now, let me help you understand this. When you get your energy bill from DTE and it shows you how much energy you're consuming, what you're not aware of is that there's a loss factor between when the energy comes out of the ground and DTE converts that fossil fuel into electrical or whatever it's sending to your house of about 3.25. So what we're thinking of is even though my house on site might be net zero energy, I have this additional energy that's lost through generation and transmission. So it's kind of like if you have a 70 mile per gallon car, it's actually performing at 20 miles per gallon.
So what we've got and what we've been living with is inefficient and leaky and expensive.
Exactly. And unhealthy.
And unhealthy. Because this is healthier?
Why this is healthier is, let's go back to that ventilation question. So for certification, we look at net energy use for the year, annual heating and cooling, peak heating and cooling. We look at source energy. And then we also look at air leakiness. So what we do during construction is we test the house to see how leaky it is by using a device called a blower door. And what that essentially is a gasket that we put in that closes off your front door. And then in the gasket, there's a fan that's attached. The fan turns on and sucks the air out of the house, depressurizing the house. We drop the pressure so that we have the equivalent of a 50-mile-per-hour wind blowing at the house on all sides, and then we measure the air leakiness. We have to hit a certain metric to meet passive house certification. Now, let's see if I've got this straight. We're looking at focusing on our energy use, both at the house and also at the generation plant. We're looking at making a super tight house. What's going to happen, Cynthia, if I put you and your family in a house that's super tight, like a thermos bottle, and then I tighten the lid up, is over a course of a few days, you're going to asphyxiate because you won't have enough fresh air coming into the house.
Okay.
And the moisture that you're going to be generating through washing and bathing and just transpiration. So what we do with a passive house is we ventilate it, but we ventilate it in a controlled fashion. And what we do is use something called an energy recovery ventilator. So imagine that 3-foot square hole that we talked about that most houses have. We're going to still have a 3-foot hole, but it's going to be bringing air through a device that can take 80% of the heat energy off the outgoing air and put it back on the incoming air and also recover the humidity. So it's like having a hole in your building or a window opening without having the energy penalty.
This is fascinating. It's like looking into the future of what we need. Is it expensive to build a passive house?
The fundamental question is looking at the cost, the return on investment. What we find is a passive house typically costs anywhere from 10 to 15% more than a conventionally built home. But what I always caution people to look at is understanding the difference between price and cost. Price you pay once, cost you pay forever. And the concept with a passive house is we are going to make a higher investment on the front end in a more durable, more healthy, more energy efficient home, but you will get that payback over time. And what we are finding is that we are so used to living in conventional homes that when people have a chance to visit a passive home, they can't believe it's been described as womb-like, W-O-M-B. Because in most of our houses, as you walk past windows, you feel the convective energy flow, you feel the radiant energy exchange, and we just get accustomed to having these hot and cold spots in our house. In a passive house, the temperature doesn't vary by more than 70 degrees anywhere in the entire home, and that is by design. And people that have the opportunity to visit and live in passive houses never can even imagine living in a conventionally built home.
We're changing the thermostat up and down, and exactly. Some parts of the house are cold and some are too warm and
exactly.
So on. So many great ideas start out as something rare that is very expensive, available only to a very few, from flat screen TVs to laptops, so on and so forth, and then eventually becomes something available to the masses, if you will. Is this the type of thing where you're on this cutting edge of things where it can eventually work its way into general construction practice?
That is exactly what's happening. Like you're suggesting, like flat screen TVs, any other new technology, when you're out there on the forefront of that, there is going to be a learning curve and there is going to be a little higher expense on the front end. But what we're seeing already happening is an exponential growth in the number of passive houses being built in the country. In fact, what's happening on the East Coast in Pennsylvania is they are recognizing the long-term benefit of passive house performance, and they're requiring that for public projects, public housing projects. Passive house is now the code minimum in Belgium for all new buildings. It's code in Germany. I tell the story that at one point in time, we had single-pane windows, and we had walls with no insulation on it. We do a lot of projects with remodeling, and we go and visit homes that are built in the 20s, and they have a grand total of zero insulation in their walls. At some point in time, some yahoo rode into town and said, you know what, I'm going to add some insulation to those walls. And that was probably looked at as revolutionary. And then someone came in and said, I'm going to go from a single-pane window to a double-pane window. In our lifetime, Cynthia, we will be very, very comfortable with triple pane windows. That's just going to be a matter of course. It's just like if you remember when automotive industry first came on the scene in 1900s, within 10 years, the automobile became the primary source of transportation and the horse was now behind us.
It was fast.
And we are seeing that same thing happening right now. And frankly, the time has never been more critical. We are literally at a very significant point in the course of human history where we have an opportunity to make some decisions that are going to be determining how things are going to be playing out for our future generations.
How long do you expect it'll take before this first passive house in Washtenaw County is standing and being lived in?
That's a great question. We're going to be starting construction soon. And as part of construction, because this is something that's new and exciting, we are going to be having what we call visible green home tours. And I'm really excited to share this with you. So for something that's new and as exciting as this, people really want to get inside and look under the hood and kick the tires and learn about this stuff. That's exactly what the Visible Green Home platform does. And so at two critical points during construction, we will have weekend tour that will be every hour on the hour. It'll be myself and the builder will be taking small groups of people through the home, no more than 25, and really letting you physically see what's going on and what's happening with the project. And we're anticipating the construction is going to be somewhere between 8 and 10 months.
And how would people find out who want to see these, get on the tour? How would they get on the info list?
The best way to find out about this is to either call our office at Architectural Resource or email me at architecturalresource.com and get on our invited guest list, and then you can be sure to receive an invite to that when we do that. We'll also very likely be putting something in social media and putting things out into the market as well.
Michael Clement with Architectural Resource building the first passive house in Washtenaw County. Thank you for sharing your work with us, Michael.
It's been a complete honor and thrill, Cynthia. Thank you so much.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
A federal judge hands Larry Nassar what's essentially a life sentence for possessing child pornography. We discuss the latest after a short break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Larry Nassar's lawyers asked for leniency. Federal Judge Janet Neff was having none of it. Today, the judge sentenced the former Michigan State University and USA Gymnastics doctor to the maximum sentence, 60 years in prison on child pornography charges. He still faces sentencing in Ingham and Eaton counties after pleading guilty to 10 counts of criminal sexual conduct. More than 140 women and girls accused Nassar of sexually assaulting them, and that includes some of the biggest names in women's gymnastics. And some of the accusers were in Grand Rapids for today's sentencing, as was Michigan Radio's Kate Wells, who's with us now. Kate, how did Larry Nassar's lawyers justify that plea for leniency?
Cindy, they presented a lot of letters from his family members, his in-laws, saying, look, this is not all that Larry Nassar is. He is a good man. He's a devout Catholic. He's been a devoted dad to his autistic child. And they said he has been spending the last year in jail helping fellow inmates get their GEDs, devoting himself to prayer. And he himself said he has been praying for his victims. So they were trying to tell the judge, look, this is not all that this guy is. But as you mentioned, she was not going for it.
No, hitting him with that maximum sentence. How did he react to that maximum sentence?
He was very quiet as this happened. He didn't have any big emotional reaction. He usually doesn't in court. He did, however, make a statement to the court before the sentence had come down, which actually angered a lot of his victims. It was kind of a non-apology. He said that the child pornography is something that he has been battling with for years. He specifically compared it to somebody battling with alcoholism, says this has been a skeleton in his closet, but that he hopes people can have more awareness of this issue because of him. And he said that he has lost everything and that he prays for the people that he's hurt.
Well, when we think that the feds found more than 37,000 images of child pornography on his electronic devices, I mean, what do you even say to that?
And Cindy, one of the things that was so, I mean, as if none of this could be disturbing enough, one of the things that we learned in court today is that the judge mentioned that he had actually made some of these videos himself, including some, she said, of his own child. And we asked his defense attorneys about this afterwards. They would not comment on it. But that was, I think, a pretty devastating moment today.
I would say so. And I think that's something no one was aware of until this moment. Now, you did talk with one of the many accusers.
Yeah, several of the accusers were there in court, dozens of them, their parents holding hands. Some of them afterwards decided that they did want to make statements, including Rachel Den Hollander, who's one of the reasons that we are here today, and also a woman named Tiffany Thomas Lopez, who was a student and a softball athlete at MSU in the late 90s and early 2000s. And she, among others, said, yes, you know, there is some relief here today, but that they are not done.
What I was seeking was validation. And I feel like I got that in a sense when Dr. Nassar finally admitted to abusing all of us. And so there is a sense of relief within myself that I got exactly what I was asking for. And now I feel I'm still on the search for my alma mater to take responsibility.
Kate, to that point earlier this week, Attorney General Bill Schuette called on Michigan State University to release whatever they've got from that private investigation they're doing into how this all ever happened. What do we know about that?
Yeah, and we know they've got a lot. That investigator has been through hundreds of emails. He's been given free range in terms of interviews. And Bill Schuette asked for that earlier this week. We know President Simon has responded and said, boy, we cannot wait to cooperate with you, and we will have our investigator, Patrick Fitzgerald, reach out to you, which he has supposedly done, and we've not seen his response yet. If the Attorney General's office is going to release it, they haven't yet, or I haven't seen it.
Now, just to remind everybody, it's not done for Larry Nassar. He still needs to be sentenced for those 10 criminal sexual conduct charges in Ingham and Eaton counties. When is that going to be?
That's going to be next month. Victims are allowed to make impact statements there. And that will be really interesting to see how that plays out, because we don't know how many women, you know, it could be more than 100. It could be dozens who decide that they want to come face Nassar in court and tell him what this has done to their lives. The hearings start next month. It could be a long process.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells reporting to us from Grand Rapids, where Larry Nassar was sentenced to 60 years in prison on federal child pornography charges. Thanks so much, Kate.
Thanks, Cindy.
Reinventing the future by reckoning with the past and dealing with the realities of the present. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howe says that's what we're seeing in a major change for the big auto supplier, Delphi. Daniel, what has happened to Delphi?
It's split into two companies, and the Delphi that sprung out of General Motors more than 20 years ago ceased to exist. There's a new company trading on the New York Stock Exchange called Aptiv. And there's another one called Delphi Technologies, which is the old engine management, internal combustion engine aftermarket piece of Delphi that also is trading on the New York Stock Exchange. So they've split the company into two. And it's really a bet on the future of where the industry is going towards electrification, autonomous driving, zero and or clean, very clean emissions engines.
So the industry pressures that have led to this Delphi name vanishing in the split are what? Break it down for us.
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One is you've got customers that want real specialization from their suppliers. They don't want one-stop-shop suppliers like Delphi had been, which had been a company that produced all sorts of commodities. Well, in the last decade or so, they've gotten out of the commodity business and really focused on what they call technologies that are safe, green, and connected. Which I think was a real smart bet in terms of where the industry was going. And they placed that bet before it was clear this whole mobility space had emerged, which has really been a more recent phenomenon. The other thing, though, there's a downside to all of this. I mean, I think the positive thing here is you can take an old Detroit asset and make it very attractive to investors, make a lot of money for investors, and have a successful going concern. The downside is that they closed a lot of plants in the United States. They do not have a single UAW-represented plant in the U.S. They've only got 3,500 employees, roughly, or 4,000 employees in the U.S. and about 150,000 worldwide. So the U.S. is a much smaller piece. Third, they're headquartered in the United Kingdom for tax purposes. One of the reasons that you see the Trump administration pushing to lower the corporate tax rate is because there have been a lot of what are called inversions, corporate inversions, whereas American corporations move their legal headquarters oftentimes to the UK or to Ireland to take advantage of lower corporate tax rates. And Delphi was one of those companies. And these two companies will continue to be headquartered in the UK, not in the United States. There is an operational headquarters in Troy. They will continue to run Aptiv out of that here locally. But this company has survived and prospered, but it is a very different company. So it's, as I say in the piece, it's brought financial rewards, but also a lot of human cost.
And the image of Detroit, or Metro Detroit, as the, as you put it, ancestral home of auto companies and their suppliers, taking a bigger hit, isn't it?
I'm not so sure. You know, I think that one of the things we're seeing develop here, I'm writing a piece later this week about this very issue, that perceptions of Michigan and Detroit are really starting to change. And I think one of the reasons that they are changing is because this distinction between the old line auto manufacturing and the high tech technology worlds is blurring, and that the automotive industry has become is a high tech business, and they're integrating so much technology. And also you have the big names that people know in other aspects of their lives, Google and Apple, Intel, are now playing in this space and are vying for position in this space with a General Motors, with a Ford, with a Delphi, or an Aptiv. The Aptiv CEO, Kevin Clark, said to me when I talked to him a little bit about big data, and a lot of people believe that Silicon Valley is the clear favorite to emerge as the big data champion in the transportation space. He said, you know, as far as we're concerned, it's very early days for that. They do understand data. They think about it a lot, but we understand vehicle-vehicle integration and how to use a lot of that data. And these companies are now vying for talent against Silicon Valley. So people who would never consider working in the automotive space are now looking at this and saying, hey, I can do coding, I can do the real kind of high impact stuff and do it for an auto supplier, an auto company as easily as I can do it in Silicon Valley. And guess what? It's a lot cheaper to live here.
So with this Delphi split, what are the lessons in this for other suppliers?
Well, I think there's several things. One is you got to be in the right place at the right time. I talked with David Cole, who I'm sure has been on your air over the years, from the Center of Automotive Research, and he said, you know, if you're the low-cost commodity provider, you'll be okay in this business. You're not going to be a low-cost commodity provider making widgets in the United States. It's just not going to happen. So you're going to be in a foreign market.
You're going to be in Mexico.
You're going to be in Mexico. If you're supplying in the U.S. market, you're going to be in Mexico. Mm-hmm. If you're supplying the Asian market, you're probably going to be in China.
Yeah.
Or Eastern Europe for the European markets. And it's all kind of regionalized. But I think, you know, you have to be on the leading edge of technology. And one of the things that Delphi has, or Aptiv, has I think, demonstrated in the last few years is they are on the leading edge of technology, and they're giving the market what it wants. And if you are on that leading edge, you can be very successful, and you can command higher multiples in the marketplace, number one, and you can vie for a lot more customers, number two. I mean, a company like Aptiv has got a very large order book that's measured in billions in terms of orders that they've got coming in and expected over the next 24, 36, 48 months. And I think that same thing applies to the auto companies. If you're on the leading edge of technology, your multiples are going to reflect that. And the best example we have of that locally is General Motors versus Ford. General Motors in the last 6 to 8 months has seen its stock really move 10, 12, 13%. Because I think they're starting to demonstrate that they are on the leading edge of technology when it comes to autonomy. And a lot of people expect that the first automaker that's going to have autonomous vehicles on the road in any kind of numbers is going to be General Motors. Ford, on the other hand, is not there. And they are trailing behind, and it is reflected in how the market and investors see their stock and whether they want to own them, because they don't feel that yet that they're on the leading edge. And if they are and they're hiding it or they don't want to talk about it yet, there's nothing the investor can do about that until they have some real knowledge and understand that that's happening. So I think that's the real lesson of a company like Delphi, is it's positioned itself on the leading edge. And their CEO said to me this week, you know, we have to stay there. This is all a technology game. And if we don't stay there, then all bets are off.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
Think winter in Michigan. Many people will instantly think of skiing or ice skating. More and more people, though, think of a team of dogs pulling a sled through snow-covered fields and forests. Dog sledding is getting more popular in Michigan. People are seeking out the mushing experience at places like Nature's Kennel Sled Dog Racing and Adventures in McMillan in the Upper Peninsula. It's owned by musher Tasha Steelstra, who is with us now. Tasha, welcome.
Thank you.
You know, there are a lot of us who have never had the chance to experience or maybe even see dog sledding, except maybe a quick clip in a movie or something. Take us through a perfect dog sledding moment. What's it like for you? Take us there with you.
Oh, it's, you know, unlike no other winter sport because it's truly silent. You know, I think you mentioned skiing and ice skating and, you know, what's popular in the UP a lot here is snowmobiling, which when you're on a snowmobile, it's always loud and there's always an engine. And the dogs are so excited to run. It's their favorite time. They bark and go crazy and howl and sing. And then you leave the dog yard and it becomes silent. And that rush of the sled and just panting of dog breath. And it's pretty magical. You kind of feel a connection to nature that's even probably different than just going for a walk in the woods. Being pulled by an animal is pretty unique. And, yeah, see some areas of the country that are kind of inaccessible otherwise, which is, again, pretty unique and just that magic of winter feel.
You do. You make it sound magical. And you've actually made it your business?
We have. My husband, Ed, and I have been in the Upper Peninsula now for 15 years doing dog sled adventures and racing full time.
So give us an idea of the kind of things you offer people when they come to say, all right.
I'm doing this.
I'm doing this. First of all, do people actually, you know, can they drive a team or is it you can sit in the sled and let the dogs do it for you? What do you get to
do? Yeah, you can do either one. And so most of what we do is people learning to drive their own team. Hey, I saw a movie or I read a book or somebody told me about, you know, this sport. How can I try it? And I find that if people are coming all the way up here, I tell them, you know, you got to do the real deal. If you think you're physically capable of driving your own team, drive your own team. And so we offer kind of three main experiences. We do a 10-mile trip, and that's suitable for people of all ages and all abilities. They can choose to ride in the sled with a guide, or they can drive their own dog team. And we're on the trail about an hour and a half. And then we do a 20-mile trip. And then for those who want the real deal, we do an overnight trip. And we go 20 miles to a little camp that we call Musher's Village, which has a yurt and a cabin and a sauna and a cook shack. And we stay for the night and we bed the dogs down and we do dinner and have a big bonfire. And then we mush out the following day.
How many dogs do you have?
We own about 180 dogs.
And just a little bit of primer, you know, the ABCs of mushing. How many dogs in a team?
We run six dog teams with our new guests that are driving teams. But when we do competitive racing, it can be anywhere from 12 to 16 dogs pulling a sled.
And when you talk about actually, you know, being able to drive a team, you mentioned 10 years old. So is this something that a kid could do?
Something that definitely a kid could do. And I do a lot of trips for families of, like, young teenage kids, that 11 to 15-year-olds were like, oh, nothing's cool. I don't want to do that, you know, but you put that kid behind a dog team and you really see something pretty special in your middle school kid. I know a lot of parents think, what's special in my middle school kid? But, you know, they're in control of something and they're driving something and they're all of a sudden doing it. And most of the time they're better than their parents are at it. It's pretty empowering, both for kids and adults. You know, to really step out of the box and do something you've never done before. And we live in a world where we kind of do everything all the time. But to put everybody on the same playing field is pretty unique for a family.
And do you get people from outside of Michigan as well?
I do, yeah. Again, I think Michigan has done a great job advertising in Ohio, Illinois, kind of the Midwest. But we get people that fly in from all over the country and really all over the world. They may be living in the Detroit area, but from France or China and working in the auto industry for a few years. So they come up because this is very unique and different in the United States that we could do this. So we do. And, you know, I think more people realize that Michigan has great snow. You don't have to fly to Alaska to go dog sledding.
Tasha Steelstra is a musher and the owner of Nature's Kennel Sled Dog Racing and Adventures in McMillan in the Upper Peninsula. Thank you so much for being with us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, Tyler Scott, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.